Welcome to Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK, Radio 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. My name is Manuel Criollo, and I'm your host for today's show here at Voices from the Frontlines. We have a very exciting show. We'll start off today's show with Thomas Kim, Executive Director of the Korean Policy Institute, who'll join us to discuss the current negotiations between the North Korea, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and the U.S. Then we'll be joined by Walt Sinterfit, a National Board Chair of the Community HIV/AIDS Mobilization Project, CHAMP, who will join us to discuss their social justice approach to ending the AIDS epidemic. And finally, for our third segment, we'll be joined by Cindy Sheehan, who will join us to discuss her recent anti-war activism and her decision to run against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. That and more, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We'd like to welcome Thomas Kim to the show. He's an associate professor of politics and international relations at Scripps College and the executive director of the Korean Policy Institute. Thomas joins us to discuss the recent negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Hi.
So let's give the listeners a little bit. I know on September 3rd, 2007, both here in the U.S. and you heard some rumors in the U.S. and then particularly the Korean Central News Agency had stated that the U.S. had agreed to remove North Korea from the State Department's state sponsor of terrorism, which also includes things like Cuba, Iran, Sudan, and Syria. The following day, Christopher Hill, top negotiator for the United States, stated that the U.S. would not remove North Korea from the state sponsors of terrorism list. Can you talk a little bit about the history and the current state of negotiations between North Korea and the U.S.?
Sure. Well, as far as the removal from the terrorism list, this is something that has been a big sticking point for North Korea for quite some time, and frankly, it's pretty much impossible to imagine that you're going to end up with some kind of deal that sticks between North Korea and the U.S. that doesn't involve North Korea coming off of that list. And really, the issue is not at all whether or not North Korea is a sponsor of a state tariff, but really it has much more to do with the status of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and North Korea. So if it happens, which I think most people at this point hope and expect that it will, if the process moves forward, if it happens, then it really is not as if the State Department suddenly decided that North Korea wasn't going to be a sponsor of state chair, but rather it's an indication that the United States is serious about normalization with North Korea.
Well, you know, I think that that you're right. I mean, obviously, on one hand, that would be a big diplomatic victory for the DPRK if they're able to get off the list, which I'm assuming is almost impossible, especially under the new guise of, you know, not under the guise of, you know, George Bush's administration.
Sure.
But where do you think we're at? I mean, obviously, from one hand, if we looked at 4 years ago when the last elections, I felt, wow, I was really scared for DPRK. You know, most of the Democrats, instead of taking a war against Iraq, were saying, well, we should go attack North Korea, we should go attack Iran. And at least for at this moment, it seems like there's been a backing down from the U.S. and its very aggressive talks. What's been the role of both the DPRK in making this outreach to the U.S., but also at the same time, what's the role of all the other countries involved in this process of negotiations?
Sure. Well, let me first start by saying that since you mentioned Iraq and Iran, mm-hmm. it is important to recognize that what's going on in the Middle East actually has a direct implication on what's going on in North Korea. By that I mean that at a time, I think it was much more likely, as you were saying 4 years ago, there was real fear about what was going to happen with the U.S. possibly doing a preemptive attack on North Korea. And actually, I think part of what's happened is that Iraq has been so obviously a disaster that the impetus, the push to actually attack North Korea as well has really become secondary. And in fact, I think it's very interesting because as everyone agrees that Iraq has been such an albatross around the Bush administration, part of what that has meant is that the Bush administration is sort of looking for ways to achieve some kind of serious diplomatic victory before they leave. And in that, I think that they see the possibility of having something go down with North Korea. Now, a lot of that is because they know, as does everyone who's actually been paying attention to North Korea for the last 15 or 20 years, that for North Korea, the critical policy goal for North Korea has been for a long, long time, foreign policy goal, has been normalization with the United States. And so it's not as if the Bush administration hasn't known that really what the North Koreans want is peace. They've known that ever since they've gotten into office. And so it's in that sense, it is, I think, ultimately very important to realize that what's going on with regard to North Korea is actually deeply tied to what's going on with the Middle East, and it always has been. And that even includes the South Korean government sending troops to Iraq. The South Korean government was the third largest troop contingent to Iraq, and that had everything to do with the South Korean government seeking to essentially get the Bush administration to play a softer line on North Korea. Now, frankly, the Bush administration didn't pay any attention to the South Korean government, and it's really only been the disaster in Iraq, I think, that has been sort of the political push to try and settle things with North Korea. Now, that and also, of course, the nuclear device that went off. The interesting thing about the nuclear device is that when you think of it, you think of it as a militaristic move, as a very aggressive militaristic move. And, of course, on some level it is, but it's also, for the North Koreans, very much a diplomatic effort. It was an effort to basically say to the Bush administration, listen, we're going to keep moving forward, and if you're not serious about talking with us, then we're going to keep moving forward. And I think in that sense, frankly, although it seems quite odd and paradoxical that exploding a nuclear device could actually be a diplomatic move, it was actually quite successful for the North Koreans to have done that.
I mean, obviously, from my perspective, it's even crazy that the U.S. is attempting to regulate who or shouldn't, or who can and who shouldn't have nuclear armaments when they've been the only real purveyors of, you know, of using nuclear armament. We're talking to Thomas Kim, who is the executive director of the Korean Policy Institute and also a professor of politics, international relationships, Scripps College. Well, from your perspective, what do you think would be the main demands that North Korea wants to achieve? While obviously the goal to be removed out of the list of terrorism, the so-called list of terrorism, what are some other diplomatic goals that the DPRK has in relationship to these negotiations?
Sure. Well, I think the big thing, of course, is that they need economic development. They've known for a long time that they need economic development, and they've also known that, and this is in the context, of course, of their analysis 20-odd years ago, and this analysis of theirs has been going on for a long, long time. They knew 20 years ago that the geopolitical situation of the world was changing. They could see what was going on with the Soviet Union before it declined, before it collapsed. They knew that it was going to have a significant impact on their economy and their ability to keep up technologically with the South Koreans and with everyone else. And so they started to reach out, and especially after the Soviet Union collapsed, they really started to reach out to capitalist countries. Now, it didn't take them very long to figure out that no matter what they did with South Korea or Japan or anywhere else, that really, unless they normalized with the United States, that they really could not get on with the business of trying to reshape their economy and rebuild their economy after the collapse that it suffered. And so the primary diplomatic goal has been, of course, normalization. Now, with that is going to come, from their perspective, badly needed permanent supply of some sort of energy. The famine in North Korea, the difficulties that North Korea has had, a great, great deal of it is can be tied directly to the lack of a consistent energy source. And it's I think people forget with North Korea that basically we are talking about a very industrialized society. that was chugging along quite well and, in fact, had been surpassing South Korea during most of its existence until, of course, the late 80s and the advent of the fall of the Soviet Union, a number of natural disasters that came up and just the general collapse of the agricultural economy. But a lot of that is tied to energy. And so one of the big diplomatic gains, I think, that the North Koreans are looking for is they're just trying to figure out some sort of stable basis for energy, which is, of course, one of the fundamental reasons why they went forward with the nuclear programs that they did. They're looking at the South Koreans, and they say that the South Koreans have something like 16, I think, nuclear power plants. Just announced plans for 2 more nuclear power plants, and the North Koreans, of course, are thinking, well, we've got to get some of that because we don't have a firm supply of energy, and without that, they're not going to be able to achieve their goal of national sovereignty. So that's part of what we're looking at. Part of this also is they're looking to normalize relations with Japan for a number of reasons. One of which is that they're looking also for investment from Japan in the form of reparations for 35 years of colonization from 1910 to 1945. There's that as well. But even more than that, I think the biggest picture of the biggest thing that for the North Koreans is unification, of course, with South Korea. And the U.S. has been consistently an opponent to unification. At the very best, you could say that they've done nothing, which has essentially meant that they've been opposed to it because all their policies assume a divided Korea. And at worst, they've been an active opponent of unification. And so normalization with the U.S. is a really critical, huge step toward unification with the South. And that, I think, is the goal for both North and South Koreans and Koreans, frankly, everywhere.
You know, at the office down at the Strategy Center, you know, one of our main teachers, Leanne Hirsch Mann, has, you know, got into a hold of this whole report by the CIA, you know, like the 50-year sort of outlook of what we should look at. And in it, you know, in each of the scenarios that the CIA has sort of painted about the future, the unification of Korea seems to be right high on the... In other words, it's almost an inevitable motion that even the United States itself understands. We got about another 2 minutes. Why don't you give us at least some sense of how? What's the type of work that you're doing to try to support, you know, both the motion to bring some level of, you know, normalized relationships with DPRK, and I'm assuming this broader discussion about unification in the peninsula.
Sure. Well, one of the big things that the Korea Policy Institute is trying to do is basically we're just trying to get people in the U.S. up to speed about what's going on the Korean Peninsula. Mm-hmm. There have been tremendous changes in the last 7-8 years in Korea, and unimaginable, I think, to people even 10 years ago, and the kind of conversations that are going on in South Korea. In many ways, the working assumption in South Korea is that unification is already happening, that really, you know, and I have been saying this for quite some time, that I think in 10, 15 years, we're going to look back at this era that we're in right now, and we're going to say, yeah, unification is going on right now. It's just that a lot of people have in their minds a sort of an immediate unification, and what's going to happen is something much closer to a phased unification, which is what both North and South want. It's just going to go on building over time with cultural, even military, political, economic exchanges. The new summit that's coming up, in October, they're talking about doing some major expansions of economic trade between North and South Korea, which already has jumped this year in the first 7-8 months. And so part of what we're doing is we're just trying to explain to folks that there's some really tremendous changes going on. And frankly, we think it is true that unification is just, a divided Korea is just not a sustainable situation. There's just too much tension there on both sides, and there's too much unhappiness. There's still too many people divided. It's just not a feasible situation. And so I think the CIA is right. I think the progressives in South Korea are right. That people on the ground in South Korea think unification is happening, and so does the CIA. And we certainly do as well. And so part of it is just trying to get people to understand that. Because if you don't understand that that's what's going on, then it's hard to get into the mix of things.
Well, Thomas, how do people get a hold of the Korean Policy Institute?
They can reach the Korea Policy Institute through our website. Mm-hmm. It's kpolicy.org. That's kpolicy, kpolicy.org. And our contact information is on there.
Well, thank you very much, Thomas Kim, Executive Director of the Korean Policy Institute, and also Professor of Politics and International Relations at Scripps College. We'll be right back with our next guest, Walt Centerfit of the Community HIV/AIDS Mobilization Project. You can live your life.
K KPFK's Fun Drive begins in early October. We're currently recruiting volunteer food coordinators for that drive. Food coordinators arrange for meals for our many volunteers during Fun Drive periods and are an integral part of the functioning of the Fun Drives. It's a fun and rewarding position. Volunteers will need to begin as soon as possible, as arrangements need to be made in advance of the Fun Drive period. To volunteer, contact our volunteer coordinator, Tony, at 818-985-2711, extension 513, or email us at volunteer@kpfk.org.
You can walk along the crowded street. But the city really ain't no bigger.
Welcome back, everyone. The fight for HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment is a critical social justice struggle. Low-income communities of color, and particularly inside the Black community, which faces increased rates of infection and limited access to preventive care and medicines. And today we're joined, you know, this is an important discussion that I think often is not discussed. And so today we're going to be joined by Walt Centerfit. He's National Board Chair of CHAMP, the Community HIV/AIDS Mobilization Project, who organizes for prevention policies that attack the root causes driving that epidemic, including looking at issues like poverty, racism, homophobia, and gender-based violence. Welcome, Walt, to the show. We're pleased to have you on.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
On one hand, you know, I want you to talk about your own history. We met a year ago. You talked a lot about your long commitment in the struggle for civil rights, queer rights, workers' rights. And over the last 20 years, you've taken really seriously this struggle against this genocidal epidemic of HIV/AIDS.
Right. I started out by growing up in the apartheid era South, and at a time when I, as a white kid, was by law prohibited from going to school with Black students, and as well as enjoying any other kind of social equality in town or equal access to things. And I just happened to see this early on as something that was wrong and should be fought against, and so started trying to organize Black and white high school students together back around the late 50s and early 60s in North Florida. So since then, it's kind of been a touchstone that's grown from one thing to another, but the fight for solidarity with and support of Black liberation in the U.S. always has struck me as the touchstone defining social reality for the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so it's probably not surprising that then working through many movements and at the same time as a gay man who has seen dozens of friends killed by this epidemic and by the failure of a government response, and as someone who was scientifically trained and as a nurse and then later in public health, this seemed to be the place where I could bring together my personal history with an urgent need of a social justice and broader historical perspective to fighting the AIDS epidemic. Because HIV isn't just a virus, it's a manifestation of social equality. It thrives and has grown both domestically and internationally, and still, despite a lot of advances, exists today, primarily and most virulently in communities and in settings where a variety of social burdens and injustice exist. And so I personally helped found CHAMP 4 years ago with Julie Davids from Philadelphia and several other people on the East Coast as an organizing center to try to rebuild and strengthen the progressive roots of an HIV/AIDS movement in this country and link it up with other progressive social struggles, because we can't conquer HIV without attacking the root causes.
Well, what, let's talk about that, because I think, you know, while I don't want to spend too much time in a long sort of, you know, history of the HIV/AIDS movement in, you know, in terms of resistance against it, I know you had some level of involvement with ACT UP, and mm-hmm. as an organizer, when you look at the major campaigns, ACT UP and the experience and the amazing breakthrough in capturing the imagination and actually shifting debate and policy was a major breakthrough in the movement. And, you know, now if we look at 15, 20 years later, I used to work at a free clinic out here in Pico Union, Clinica para las Americas, who was doing some very amazing breakthrough work around HIV prevention and education. And yet it seemed that there was a big divide between a movement that actually was able to shift debate, and one that was actually only doing prevention, which was very important. But at the end of the day, are we losing the war in some ways?
I think in some ways we are. We've won, and I think, you know, it's a contradictory and complex picture, and we shouldn't lose sight of any part of it. As you say, ACT UP was a movement. The AIDS Coalition Unleash Power brought together the experiences of various civil rights movement and the women's health movement, and a commitment to militant direct action to shift, to grab public attention and shift the focus of the debate. And it was successful in that. And I think it was one of the primary reasons why there was a rapid acceleration of research, and furthermore, research that was willy-nilly, not always willingly, accountable to the community, because we were in there watching what the scientists were doing, watching what questions were being prioritized, watching how money was being allocated. And that led more or less directly to the successes, so that now for people that have access to care, the life expectancy of someone who is getting infected today is about 40 years versus 5 to 10 years when the epidemic started. Mm-hmm. And that's an amazing record of progress. But it's not simply medical progress that happened in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. It's progress that happened only because of social pressure. And furthermore, then what began to happen is that that it was not equally accessible to everybody, both, you know, internationally especially, and even domestically. More than 50% of people don't have effective access to the most effective life-saving treatments now. And as we demanded a government response, the flip side of that, the underside of that, is that we created a government bureaucracy so that most people who were doing HIV work moved from the streets into clinics, into government organizations, with all of the political restrictions that were imposed as a part of the process, especially on prevention. And that's part of what we have to unlock and unleash now, is things like, I mean, ordinary things like just that abstinence doesn't work, but yet that's being promoted by law with an amazing proportion of the government's prevention money. That condoms and clean needles do work and are not effectively provided to large segments of the population who need them. Let alone, we haven't yet developed new technologies. I mean, things like microbicides and pre-exposure prophylaxis and a vaccine that we need in terms of prevention. But despite all of those, a lot of parts of prevention aren't going to be successful, because it's not the individual behavior alone or just the virus, but it's the social conditions under which people live. Mm-hmm. One way to illustrate that, and one of the things that we're working on, is prisons. 25% of the people with HIV have been or are under the control of the so-called criminal justice system in the country. But yet, less than 5% of the state and county jails and 10% of the federal prisons have any kind of HIV prevention programs or services. And then people come out of prisons without access to housing, employment, education, and are very likely to go back in. This has boomerang and multiplying effects on communities, especially communities of color. So what we would say is that we have to fight for not just effective prevention using the science we have in prisons and upon release from prison, but we have to look at shrinking the whole prison industrial complex, which is another word for the criminal justice system, in the first place, through things like sentencing reform and alternatives to incarceration.
Right, absolutely. With 2.3 million people in prisons in this country, that's a huge civil rights and human rights. So let's talk a little bit about where CHAMP wants to go. One of the things that I see a lot is you both have an international perspective, and yet, as you were saying, you looked at the central question around particularly the epidemic inside the Black community as it being a very central aspect of raising demands against the government. Talk about some of your demands, and, you know, what's the game plan and how people can get involved. We have about another 5 minutes, and it'd be great for you to give folks that information.
Some of the demands that we are raising are being sharpened not just by us, but by a whole coalition of community groups that we have helped catalyze in conjunction with a thing that we call the Prevention Justice Mobilization. We call our concept of of HIV prevention through social justice. We call it prevention justice, where we have to link the public health aspects of HIV prevention with the social justice fights. And so we're having a prevention justice mobilization this fall that has already involved 100 different local organizations that will be coming together both locally around World AIDS Day, which is December 1st, with a prevention justice focus this year, and then the following week, December 3rd through 6th, in Atlanta, where the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and the other federal agencies are having a conference that they have every 2 years on sort of the state of the art about HIV prevention. And we're going to use an inside and outside approach at that conference coming off of these regional and local mobilizations to put demands that are still being formulated, but some of the things that have been raised are cut the number of new infections in this country by 50% within 5 years. Right now, the CDC is just releasing data that it looks like not 40,000, but 50,000 people are being infected anew every year. Cut that to under 25,000 within 5 years. Reduce the disproportionate impact on the African American and Latino communities within 5 years. Provide prevention services and reduce post-release encumbrances to people that are incarcerated. Make available condoms and clean needles to everybody in this country that needs it. And fight for a prevention research agenda that arises from the real needs of people who are on the front lines in the communities and is accountable to it. So we're excited that a number of people around the country are mobilizing around this kind of agenda, and specifically saying, and this is important, that the process of building the movement and linking HIV and AIDS to other social justice issues and implanting the importance of fighting for HIV and AIDS prevention justice within other social movements is a key task for this mobilization and this movement. And secondly, the key part of it is that we want to rise above just fighting for, like, my community needs more money. No, your community needs more money. Your community gets too much. That we have to rise above that and demand fundamental policy changes and more money for the whole fight.
We have about another minute. How can people get a hold of you and get a hold of CHAMP?
People can look at our website, which is champnetwork.org, just CHAMPNETWORK.org. They can write or call me locally, WSENTERFIT at AOL.com, or they can call 323-953-8501. That's our local office, 323-953-8501. And I would be delighted, and we would be delighted to link people up or to provide more information or to come out and make presentations to community groups about concrete ways in which people can link up with this mobilization.
Well, thank you, Walter Centerfit. He's National Board Chair of the Community HIV/AIDS Mobilization Project, CHAMP. And we'll take a short break, and we'll be back with our next guest, our anti-war activist, Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan suffered a devastating blow when she lost her 24-year-old son, Casey, in the Iraq War in April 2004. A little over a year after this tragedy, in August of 2005, Cindy Sheehan came to the prominence when she set up an anti-war camp outside George W. Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. The month-long protest focused the attention of a large number of people in the U.S. and around the world about the human cost of the occupation of Iraq. Sheehan's protests both helped shift U.S. public opinion and obliged the media to acknowledge what they had taken great effort to conceal, the existence of widespread opposition to the Iraq war within the United States. It's my pleasure to welcome Cindy Sheehan to the show.
Well, thank you.
There's a whole set of conversations I'd like to have with you. I definitely want to get to the conversation about you running against Nancy Pelosi, but I've been reading a lot of things about you. You were a mom, it seems, an eligibility worker, a youth outreach minister,
and you've sort of been catapulted to the most important debates of our time. What has that meant for you? What has that shifted for you?
Well, I think the major turning point in my life, of course, was when Casey was killed. I am a mom. I always will be a mom. Mm-hmm. I have four children. I still have four mm-hmm. children. Just because Casey's mm-hmm. dead doesn't mean that, you know, his memory or the love that our entire family has for him is dead. So being a mother is something that, you know, you can't resign from. You're always a mother. And when, you know, Casey's death is the, like I said, it was the major turning point in my life. I was never, ever going to be the same again. So I just really have, throughout the course of these last 3.5 years since Casey died, have been continually amazing myself at the resolve and the strength that I have had in the face of his death to try and make the world a better place. And before he was killed, you know, trying to imagine one of my children dying and burying one of my children was like my worst fear. And I could never get past that, thinking, oh my God, if one of my kids dies, I'm just going to have to go to bed for a couple of years mm-hmm. under heavy medication. And I admired people like John Walsh of the Adam Walsh Foundation and Candy Leitner of MAD so much for using their sorrow and their tragedies to help other people, but I didn't think I could ever do that. Mm-hmm. So it just has been this path I've been on since Casey died has been very, you know, gratifying. It's been really amazing. It's been really energizing as well as challenging and debilitating, you know, all at the same time. And I have to do all this stuff that I'm doing, that I feel compelled to do, also suffering through every day, every minute of every day, the loss of my oldest child.
One of the first shows we ever did here on Voices from the Frontlines was with Fernando Suarez de Solar, and it must have been, you know, maybe weeks after his son had died, and you can hear the massive pain that he carried. Obviously, you know, here, especially in Los Angeles and especially in the Southwest, he's been such an important figure for a lot of Chicano and Latino activism against the war.
Right.
And I can only imagine, I lost a father at a very young age in a very violent way, and I know how painful it is to lose a loved one.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, obviously, on one hand, the drive of your son's death and the outrage against the war has also catapulted you to go to Jordan. Last year, you were in Guantanamo. I was in Caracas, Venezuela at the World Social Forum a couple of years ago, and I know you're one of the main figures there. And politically, how has that transformed yourself? I mean, I don't know your politics that well. I haven't read much about what they were, but how different are you from the person in 2003?
Well, I think, you know, I grew up during the 60s mm-hmm. and 70s, and I was really young when the Vietnam War was going on. I resonated with the protesters and with ending the war, but you know, I never marched in any marches. I was in junior high, and I wasn't very political. Then I was married very young and started having children very young. And although I've been always really liberal and progressive, I thought, you know, being a Democrat was liberal and progressive. And since Casey died and since I've worked so much here in D.C. on the Hill with Democrats and some Republicans and worked against the policies of the Bush administration, which most of the Republicans support fully, and the Democrats support also, you know, maybe they don't say they support them, but they support them with their votes, their actions, their lack of action also. So I just have come to the conclusion over these last 3 years that we basically in the United States have a one-party system, that both parties, Gore Vidal likes to call them the Banker's Party because they're controlled by special interests, moneyed interests, the Eastern elite establishment, you know, no matter if you're in California or in the East, you know, those are the people who run our government still. And even though they've thrown bones to people of color and women to give them the vote, we're really disenfranchised because our votes don't count, for one thing, with the electronic voting machines mm-hmm. that are programmed and owned by Republicans and the establishment. And our elected officials do not do what we elect them for. In November of 06, the country elected Democrats back in the majority of both houses to be an opposition party finally to George Bush, and they haven't been. So I think that's what it is. I think that we need to, and that's what my candidacy in California's 8th district up in San Francisco, I'm hoping to do with it, is to challenge this corporate establishment elite, to say that finally, after all these years, the people of America want to be represented, not the corporations.
It's interesting you say that. Last year, around this time, we had both Jody Davis and Hani Khalil. And, you know, there was a lot of hope. And I had felt bad after both of those interviews because I felt like I wasn't being belligerent. But, you know, I work every day here in Los Angeles challenging transit racism. I work with the Bus Riders Union, and I see how hard it is to move the system, even for things that you would assume there'd be a lot of unity, you know, providing low bus fares and a lot of service for folks who need it. And yet constantly it's not Republicans, it's Democrats who are essentially promoting and impose some very dramatic and draconian cuts. And so at that time, I felt bad because I was basically saying, how real can we expect the Democrats to really provide some form of opposition given their past history? And anyways, I had felt really bad about those interviews, and not in the sense of politically, but I had felt in the moment, the thing that was really pushing me on some level was the history and the everyday interaction I have had with this party and how disappointing it has been. So let's talk right now. I know there's a move from what I've been reading in the internet and with different friends. There seems to be a call for unity and then escalation of tactics by a lot of the forces in the anti-war movement, as broad and, you know, as divided as been. You yourself, I know, just this week with Reverend Yearwood, were at the hearing with General Petraeus, and I know you led an action there.
Well, I actually, Reverend and I and my sister, who was arrested with us, did not get into the hearing. We were arrested outside of the hearing. So, yeah, there were some people who got into the hearing, my oldest daughter Carly included, who interrupted the hearing, and she was arrested. But we never even got in there. When I heard and saw the D.C. cops piling on my dear friend Reverend Lennox Yearwood, I went up to ask them why and, you know, to try and stop them from doing that, and then I was arrested.
Hmm. I'm assuming you have a good sense of the anti-war movement. Where do you think it's going at this moment? As I said, there is a call for some broad sense of unity and an escalation of tactics. Now that you're running, how is that going to impact some of your work in the anti-war work?
Well, you know, In May I removed myself from the anti-war movement and went into humanitarian work, and I believe that holding George Bush and Dick Cheney accountable for what they've done by impeaching them, removing them from office, doing international war crimes tribunals mm-hmm. against them is a humanitarian effort. I am here in Washington, D.C. to participate in the Answer March and Rally this Saturday, but the only reason I agreed to participate in it is they are going to do some massive civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the only direction that we can go in now. We've marched, we've signed petitions, we've tried to exercise our, you know, democratic rights by voting. You know, we've called our congresspeople, we've lobbied them on the Hill, we've done everything, sit-ins, whatever, and it's not working. As a matter of fact, it's just gotten worse. So I think that there's many elements of the so-called anti-war movement that don't think that civil disobedience is right or needed. I just want to say to those elements that civil disobedience is the only thing that has ever caused true, relevant, and lasting change in this country. It hasn't been legislation. Maybe the legislation has come after the civil disobedience, but it's been always on people power, not relying on our elected officials that have changed things in this country. And we, how many marches are we going to have? How many, you know, and I think that having marches on the weekends are irrelevant. We march around, we look at each other. We don't inconvenience anybody except, you know, tourists in Washington, D.C. I think we need to shut this city down, put our bodies on the line. I think we need to honor the sacrifices of people in the past who have done these courageous acts of civil disobedience, everything from, you know, signing the Declaration of Independence to having boycotts in California led by Cesar Chavez. You know, we have to start doing these, and we have to be more courageous with our activism and not just say, oh, well, I marched today, so I'm going to go have beer and pizza, and I did my duty. No, the marches are not being effective. And we see public opinion is overwhelming against this war. It's overwhelming to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney, but our elected officials are not conforming to the will of the people, and it's only they're only going to do it if we make them do it.
Well said. So you're running.
Yeah.
You're running against Nancy Pelosi. For folks here in Los Angeles, why don't you describe even the district? From what I've been reading, from your perspective, she's very vulnerable in that district.
And that's really something that many people in, across the nation don't realize, that she is vulnerable in San Francisco. She has approval ratings hovering around George Bush's approval ratings in her district, and two-thirds of San Franciscans voted in a citywide referendum in November to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. I'm sure at least three-quarters of San Franciscans want the war to end and our troops to start coming home, and Nancy Pelosi is not representing the people of San Francisco. Of course, she is the Speaker of the House, so you know, she has those duties also, but first and foremost, she is a congressional rep from California's 8th District, and she is not in line. In fact, she is very disconnected, not only from people in her district, but from people in America. On July 23rd, we took a petition with over a million signatures to John Conyers to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. Even before she was elected in November, she said impeachment was off the table. Well, I'm just here to announce to her that her reelection is off the table, and I'll work hard in San Francisco to be their next representative, and then I'll work hard for the people of San Francisco, not for the special interests.
So I know on one hand, I'm very excited about it, and you know, I think a lot of people that I know are excited about your run, and I think it's an important cause to support. What has been some of the reaction? I've been reading a lot how one wing of the sort of liberal progressive forces in this country are not supporting you or are questioning your running against Nancy Pelosi. How has that impacted you? And what do you think it also is saying about, is this an important break among progressive forces to understand, you know, the difference of both principles in politics and a party?
Well, I think that what is happening with my run is it's really separating people who are true progressives from people who care more about Democrats than democracy. And there has been, if people cared about democracy, they would be supportive of my run because with the help of the Democrats, who before November of 06, their excuses were, we're in the minority. Now their excuses are, we don't have enough votes. Well, you know, those are lame excuses. They don't even test the waters, and they don't put a good case for withdrawal of Iraqi troops. They don't put a good case for impeaching George Bush and Dick Cheney. But if these so-called progressives were more interested in restoring our representative republic than propping up a Democratic Party who doesn't want the war to end because they are complicit in it, who does not want George Bush and Dick Cheney to be impeached, because if George Bush and Dick Cheney are impeached, then that means the we'll be challenging the established elite, which they're a part of. And our government is rapidly descending into a corporate military fascism with the help of the Democratic Party, with the help of these institutions that support Democrats over democracy. And I think you're really starting to see who really cares about our country and principles and who only cares about a party.
What's your three top priorities that you'll be given if elected?
Well, my top priority, of course, is accountability and bringing the troops home and ending the occupation. I care about so many other issues. I care about universal health care. I care about having education in our country from kindergarten to university that is quality education and free to everybody who wants to access this education. If we want a middle class in our country, we have to support unions. We have to support good education. We have to demilitarize our schools and demilitarize our communities and our country. And those, of course, are my top priorities. But we can't do anything else when we're spending $12 million an hour on this illegal and immoral occupation. We have to bring our troops home. We have to bring our tax dollars home. We have to bring the private contractors home. You know, many people don't know that we have 165,000 troops there. A lot of people know that, but they don't know that we have 180,000 mercenary troops there, which, you know, is scary, scary in the least. We have paid killers fighting our wars in Iraq, and we have to do something about that. And what's really exciting is I will be a Congress representative for 2 weeks when George Bush is still in office. And I will introduce impeachment resolutions. And another thing that many people don't know, if George Bush and Dick Cheney accept any kind of federal, you know, assistance after they are out of office, you know, even if they go out of office, we're still concerned about that, about them declaring martial law and suspending elections. Mm. But if they take a pension, if they take, you know, health care, if they take any kind of federal help, such as Secret Service help, they can be impeached and have that help and assistance taken away from them.
Cindy, why don't you help explain for folks what is the process right now? Where are you at, and when are elections, and how's it even running right now? And have you already started campaigning on the ground and on the streets?
In San Francisco, what we've been doing is meeting with leading activists from all kinds of organizations, environmental, political, peace, green activists. So we have been doing these meetings. Our next step is to find a campaign office, you know, get the campaign office open. Fortunately, since I'm running as non-affiliated with any party, that I don't have to run in the primaries. So the elections are in November of 08, and we're getting grassroots support from all over the country. In October, we have people in all 50 states who are willing to have house parties for me to raise money. It's going to be a grassroots campaign that is energizing the entire country. I'm hoping more people will run against the enablers of the Bush regime in their districts, whether they're Democrat or Republican. I'm hoping that people will understand that this isn't just Cindy Sheehan versus Nancy Pelosi. This is, you know, the Constitution versus Nancy Pelosi. This is the people of America versus the established elite. And I think it's going to be a very exciting campaign. And I hope it's only a small part of a movement that will eventually bring about true, lasting, and good change in this country.
Cindy, how do people get a hold of you? Or, you know, for sure, one more important thing is how do they help contribute to your campaign and support your effort and obviously support as you're saying, this much broader attempt to end the occupation and war in Iraq?
Well, we need to... we're working on my website right now, cindyforcongress.org, and our other websites, campkcpeaceinstitute.org, thecampkcpeaceinstitute.org, which talks about our humanitarian efforts. We're helping refugees. We're getting an organization partnering with Iraqi refugees in Jordan and Syria to get them direct emergency aid, which they need right now. And I think that people can support this by actively campaigning against pro-war Democrats and pro-war Republicans, and just realizing that we have to vote out of our courage, vote out of our integrity, and not vote for a party. My campaign slogan is people before politics and people before profits. And that's what we just have to get down to in this country, is that every single person who lives in this world, not just in the United States, deserves to be safe, deserves to be fed, deserves to have access to clean water and medical help. And when people of America reform our nation to have true democracy here, it will only help the rest of the world.
Cindy, thank you very much. We're very appreciative of having you on the show.
Nice to talk to you.
And we hope that you come down and visit us here in Los Angeles one of these days.
I'm sure I'll be there soon. That's where my office is.
That's great. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Manuel. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
That's the end of today's show of Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Manuel Criollo. We'd like to thank our guests, Thomas Kinn, Walt Centerfit, and Cindy Sheehan. Today we heard music from Roy Ayers, Nina Simone, Bill Withers, and Maldita Vecindad. You can listen to previous shows at www.thestrategycenter.org and send comments to voices@strategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, production assistant, Lisa Adler, Dehan Sung, and Mark Maxwell, our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. And we'll see you next week from Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman.